Testes. We need a New Year's testes.
Testes, yeah. Good one. Yeah. That doesn't get old. Happy New Year and welcome to another edition of the Beer Opinions Podcast. My name is Pat Berger of Kaiser Tiger and Patty Longs. And with me, as always, is Bruce White from the Chicago Beer Tours something.
Chicago Beer Experience. You got it. You're close. You were there, right? You were right there.
Chicago Beer Experience. Okay. Got it.
Oh, man. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yeah. Congratulations on your recent engagement. We
Thank
talked
you.
About it on the
Thank
last
you.
Podcast. She actually said yes.
She did. I'm not in Thailand. I am here still. She said yes. And, you know, enough beer, people will say anything, I think, is the moral of the
so
story.
So that's what you did? You plied her with beer
exactly.
before the popping the question? It's a good idea.
It's the only
actually,
way.
That can backfire.
As long as she never sobers up, we're fine.
Well, I'm sure she's working on that as we speak. Shout out to her. And we have a guest today. We're in the midst of a greatness, of a legend, of how do I go down the list of accomplishments here? He's a blogger, he's a podcaster. Most importantly, he's a publican at one of the greatest yep. bars on the planet, certainly the greatest 4 a.m. bar that I can speak yep. of.
Published author.
Yes, and an artist.
Yep.
An accomplished artist. Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House.
All right.
The geriatric genius is in our midst. How are you, Bruce?
I'm fine. And after that intro, I'm even more in awe of myself than I was when I walked in here.
Which is saying something.
It definitely is.
No lack of ego on Bruce. So,
no.
Well, welcome to Beer Opinions. I know we're going to sort of veer off of beer a little bit today because Bruce, you know, while he drinks beer, it's mostly Budweiser on ice.
Well, I'd like to preface that by yes. saying I've been drinking beer since 1961 regularly. And back in those days, I wasn't really flush most of the time. And so I had to learn to develop a taste for really lousy, cheap beers, which I did. And because I remember the first time I went to London and they thought I was just... They were very kind of disparaging about my taste in beer, and I tried to explain to them that it was not easy to come by that.
You worked at it.
Yeah, it took a long time, because there's a lot of really good beers, you know, and every once in a while you're exposed to it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you have to learn to be, oh, God, it's not Bullfrog or Canadian Ace, that really nice
It's like flying private. You know, once you've done that, you can't go back to those commercial flights. So you're staying in the cheap seats. You're making sure you don't get used to this new fangled craft beer, right?
Well, I can make those adjustments. But then when I really hit my prime, I was drinking about 15 beers. I mean, Miller High Life. I like Miller. I like all the American beers pretty much. I would never drink Coors because they were for political purposes. But so I did.
You didn't align up with Adolf?
Adolf yeah,
Coors.
I was not about to do that. But I did. But then I was drinking about 15 beers a day. And then when your doctor asks you if you drink and you say, yeah, how often? daily. But how much? I drink about 15 beers. What? But.
I've never been honest with my doctor on that
question.
Well,
I mean, why not? You know, what the hell? I mean, if they see those capillaries blowing out of your, you know, you're exploding on your nose, they know that probably you're not telling the truth about your drinking.
Yeah, that's true. But I always say 3 to 4. I just don't ever say how big they are.
The doctor probably notices when I just start sweating profusely at that question.
The doctor notices when I have an actual beer in my hand in the waiting room. He's like, well, this guy might have a problem.
But I am not a beer snob, let me put it that way. Yeah. And I appreciate all these new craft beers. But I knew I could drink those 15 Buds and not get drunk. I mean, I could drive home okay. If I had that 16th one, maybe not. So, but with these
disclaimer, we're not suggesting you drink 15 buds and drive home.
Well, not unless you're me.
Yeah. Unless you're the geriatric genius.
If you're exceptional, if you're a genius.
Yeah. Some of us have superpowers. Bruce's is drinking 15 buds.
I can't anymore.
You can't anymore.
I have a very esoteric autoimmune thing called myasthenia gravis, which I'm not supposed to drink at all, but I made an adjustment. I drink about 3 or 4 Polish martinis a day instead of beer. Instead of my regular beer.
And the Polish martini is the Budweiser
over ice. Yeah.
Yes.
It's for you beer snobs.
I'm afraid to ask why it's called Polish or martini.
It just makes sense, doesn't it? No, I have to give credit to the bartender at the Old Town Ale House, Johnny Ale, who's amazingly, I don't know what the odds of hiring a bartender at the Old Town Ale House named with the last name of Ale.
He actually has a real last name, but
like Vonda Kaufman.
It's something long. I've never bothered to learn it. He's Johnny Ale to us because there was a Johnny. Back in the day when I worked at Corcoran's around the corner from the Old Town Ale House, we had Johnny Irish. And, since there were two Johnnies, he became Johnny Ale. There was Johnny Irish and Johnny Ale. He's still Johnny Ale to this day. He didn't like it at first, but he's grown into it.
Oh, he has, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. He'll answer to it now.
Yeah.
But Johnny Irish is long gone. He should just probably be Johnny now, but, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, the best nicknames stick. Yeah. And a legendary bartender, Johnny Ale. Shout out to
definitely.
Him.
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
And he is a mathematician.
He is. He's got his 12th degree.
He is, and he's going to be teaching at junior college this coming semester, I think.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine walking into your first junior college class, and there's Johnny Ale trying to teach him math?
I'm sure in Chicago they've seen far more frightening things than Johnny Ale.
That's probably true. That's probably true. Do you know which junior college? No, we shouldn't say
that. Well, probably not say that.
Yeah, we probably better not say that. But if you have Dr. Ale at your math teacher, know that he can sling a drink. I used to serve him as an underaged young man.
He out in the neighborhood real young.
He confessed to me that he was not 21 when I met him at Corcoran's. He was... sub 21. I guess my carding was not too strict at 2 in the morning. But
started out, I think he worked at Second City too, doing something. Like I think he was a bartender.
He started out Second City. That's
and but when he came, the woman that owned the bar prior to my ex-wife and me.
That noise. Sorry, we have some background noise going on.
Is that an airplane
on.
Crashing into the building?
There might be some work being done on the roof here at Kaiser Tiger.
We hope it's
there is
benign.
A roofer up there.
There is a roofer up
there? There is a roofer up there.
Oh, okay.
So my apologies, but it is what it is.
When we do podcasts at the Ale House, by the way, that's called as the Ale House turns.
Oh, yes.
We have background bar noise, which can get very raucous. So I'm used to distracting noises.
Yeah, yeah. The raucous background bar noise is much better than what we're hearing now. But, we will soldier on.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
We're pros.
Talking about the Old Town Ale House, let's get a little history of it. I'd like to get into the story of how you ended up as the proprietor, because it's interesting.
You're an Irishman, so you should appreciate this more than your average listener. I am an Irishman's absolute dream that if you drink in a bar long enough, they'll eventually give it to you. And it's something for you to shoot for now. You're going to have to put those 50 years in. But there's a gold lining there.
It can happen.
It can happen. Look at me.
Yeah, yeah, living proof.
Yep.
So when I first started going to the Old Town Ale House, it was owned by a man named Arthur.
Arthur and B.
Yes. Arthur and B. And to be honest, I never met them because I only went in at 3 in the morning.
Oh, you missed Arthur.
He's a legend, right?
Oh, yeah. And talk about a guy that did drank beer. In fact, I think they did a reader. Larry Rand did a feature reader article about Arthur. And Arthur, because he was a bartender at the university club, one of those private clubs downtown.
Uh-huh.
And he described all the people he felt he personally murdered over the years by serving them. And it was
a slow murder.
It was a slow murder, and he got to enjoy it and watch, you know. But and then he worked at another really kind of legendary bar called Figaro's. It was just off Rush Street. And so it was a hipster bar, and lots of drug dealers, but, you know, Rush Street type hip. When the old Rush Street nightclub district was really rock and roll, because you'd see Lenny Bruce come in. Lenny loved Arthur. Arthur just cracked him up.
So this is early 60s?
Oh, this would have been...
Late 50s?
Yeah, probably. I think... Certainly in the early 60s, Arthur was at Figaro's.
Okay.
And lots of other... And so what happened... The Old Town Ales was founded in 1958 by a guy named E.J. Van Gelder. And E.J. built a bar.
Sorry, hold on one second. I'm going to have the roofer stop for a second. Why don't we hit pause real quick? All right, we're back. Hopefully, the roofer is taking a break, and we're going to continue on with the history of the Old Town Ale House here. I think we got to the point
where E.J. Van Gelder stole the idea of the ale house from a place called Vesuvio's in San Francisco on North Beach, which I had gone to back in the late 50s. Before I was actually 21, I went out to join the Beach Generation, and it's right next to City Lights Bookstore, which Ferlinghetti owns, a famous San Francisco beatnik poet. There's this great bookstore, but right next door was this bar of Vesuvio's. So this was Van Gelder. Now Van Gelder was a really kind of brilliant guy at building bars, hiring bartenders, but he was really one of the most disgusting, vile, loathsome human beings I've ever known. And he was, and he was a cheapskate too.
Well, now you say steal the idea. What was the idea of the ale house?
They played mostly jazz. Now the Vesuvio's, I think, was mostly hipster jazz stuff. I really didn't know that much about bars in those days. Why that would be such a unique bar, but the ale house was truly unique because played only classical music off of hi-fi. The old fashioned records, 78s. I'm so old now, I can't even remember. But
I'm so young, I don't know what the technology was.
Well, anyway, it was nothing. It was a record player. No jukebox, no TV. And
that's where the idea of the jukebox at Old Town came from?
There was an evolution because the only time they played anything other than classical music at the original Ale House was... When on Fridays or Saturdays, you could bring your own records of musicals. That was the only...
So it was either classical music or musicals?
And that was just one night a week. It was all strictly classical. And then, but Van Gelder, the good thing about him was he would go to Mexico for 6 months every year. So everything was great because great bartenders, great bar, and great people, fascinating people. I mean, for a kid to come in there and all these older, you know, really interesting, older, a lot of really mean, vicious, witty people that I impressed me so much that I adopted a lot of their material.
Explains a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My early upbringing, definitely.
So you grew up in Old Town?
Well, I got there in 61.
Okay.
I grew up in a town called Downers Grove, which I refer to as Uppers Grove. And no town ever deserved a horrible kid more than they did deserve me. That I have great consolation growing up there. I gave them everything they got me, gave me, you know, in spades.
I believe that. Well, so you got down to Old Town in early 60s.
My girlfriend rented a cheap... In those days, everything was like $55 a month, a little two-bedroom frame placed right down the street from the alehouse. So I just started, hey, that's kind of a cool place. I'll start hanging around. Well, I hung around.
Hung around.
What was Old Town like back then?
Well, that it was before they widened North Avenue. You could live down there for nothing. I mean, I remember the first time we ever had to pay $100 for an apartment. I couldn't believe it. What? $100 a month? A beer at the alehouse was a quarter. You still had all the Second City was just starting out, and all those great characters in early Second City were hanging around there. A lot of jazz musicians went hanging out. There was, you know, your beginning drug culture going on. But the side of North Avenue they eventually tore down had a bunch of little old German bars and resale. There was an old movie theater. But you could live there so cheap. And then racially, the neighborhood started changing. And they basically, they widened North Avenue, and then they built this kind of wall that has become Second City now, and there's a health club, and all, which was all racially geared to keep, you know, undesirables. But I remember there was a lot of Italians, tough Italians, and the Farinas. Dennis Farina was the guy who just died, right?
The actor.
Yeah.
Well, his brother was like the toughest guy in the neighborhood, a guy named Roland Farina. He was a bartender. But his sister was almost as tough as him, Bernadette. I knew her pretty good. I'd seen her.
And he became a cop for before he became
Dennis,
an actor.
Dennis Farina was until I barely, yeah. But he was just kind of one of the little asshole kids running around the neighborhood when I first got there.
Yeah.
And so it was very, very colorful. I mean, you had all the hipsters moving in, but then you had the old, you know, tough Italians. And
were you there for the Democratic riots?
I moved to Berkeley in 19. I had to kind of one of my great books, Portrait of the Genius of a Young Man. I described the circumstances when I had to flee Chicago, but I did come back in 68 for the convention.
Okay.
And I write about that extensively in, let's see.
You have two novels, right?
Oh, California Jailbreak. That's my third novel. And I describe coming back in great detail for the convention.
For those of you who want to get that story in detail, how do they purchase your book?
Can purchase it on Amazon, or you can purchase it in person at the Old Town Ale House.
I suggest in person.
Yeah. Autograph copy.
I certainly can handle that. They're great books. They're marvelous.
They are. They chronicle the life of the genius and his pursuit to never work.
Well, and also it's interesting. When I went back to my Uppers Grove 50th anniversary, all the kids I knew, hardly kids after 50 years, but they were all talking about retiring, and I announced that I was seriously thinking about maybe joining the workforce. I had been the first kid upon graduating from Uppers Grove High School. I announced my retirement the night we graduated, and I pretty much held true to that. I just wasn't cut out for work.
Well, knowing's half the battle. Let's talk a little bit about Second City, because I think Second City's history is entwined with the Old Town Ale House, and certainly all those classic characters from Second City have been in the door of the Old Town, right?
Yes, they have. I mean, I only Tina Fey wanted to know why her portrait wasn't up on the wall. I said, because you didn't hang out here. You know, if you just came in once or twice, that was not going to.
That wasn't enough, right?
No, that wasn't enough. But so the people, we do have kind of a gallery of the famous people that actually hung around the Old Town Ale House, from Second City, although some other actors like Michael Shannon, people like that. We've had a really tight connection with, I mean, the proximity. Although when I first moved into the neighborhood, Second City was over by Wisconsin Street, about a good four blocks away. But Peter Boyle and those guys would still come over.
Yeah.
And it was really great seeing. I mean, I predicted that Severin Darden would be the biggest thing to ever come out. I mean, the guy was amazing. But Alan Arkin became much bigger than him, and Barbara Harris. And so it's funny. There's nobody over Second City now that goes back as far as those very early. So when the kid's writing a paper, because they turned this thing into a money-making school, thousands of students over there.
They got my money last summer. I sent my oldest over to a camp there.
Yeah, well, they've got a hell of a thing going on. So if some kid's writing something about the original, I mean, they'll send them over to interview me every occasion, once or twice a year. I get one of these where they want to go, you know, what was Barbara Harris really like and this and that. So we still have a connection.
Yeah, I mean, the Old Town Ale House is really the last bastion of old town. I guess that's redundant. But, you know, even when I started bartending
Twin Anchors
has not changed. You're right.
Yeah.
But I can't think of any. I mean, when I started bartending there in 99 or 2000, whenever it was, there were still some old classic bars or, you know,
The O'Rourke's was not nearly as old as us, but certainly a classic.
And O'Rourke's was still there on Halstead.
The Salad Club was also another one.
Yeah, yeah.
Old Blue Collar.
The Golden Dragon was still there. Oh,
that was, what a great place. Whether we missed that one.
Yeah, that was an awesome joint.
Yeah, I think, and Marge's is still there, but only in name. It's nothing.
Yeah.
The original Marge's was something. It was really a dump.
It's a lot nicer now.
And she lived upstairs, and she'd come down in the morning in her bathrobe smoking a cigarette, and if the bartender had his back to, you know, wasn't paying attention, I've been in there a couple times. She'd just pick up an ashtray and fire it at him. Oh, she was a tough old broad.
Yeah, it's still there, but completely revamped and much nicer than it used to be.
Unrecognizable for what it was.
Yeah, I mean, they're all, you know, they cleaned out all the peep shows. It was kind of a red light district a little bit,
It was
too.
For a while because it caught on. I mean, originally, you could just, there was not even a parking meter on Well Street. You could just park. Yeah. And then, of course, it got publicity and places were packed. And so they turned it into a real, well, that's when Van Gelder thought that the neighborhood was going straight downhill when they did that. And so he sold the bar to this really moronic guy named Joe Diaz. And Van Gelder anticipated that all the action was moving over to Lincoln Avenue. So he opened, what the hell was the name of
Four Farthings?
No, it wasn't Four Farthings. It was, I can't. It'll come to me. But it's no longer in existence.
Oh, okay.
So he got out.
Was it Sturgis?
No. Sturgis was great.
Sturgis.
Yeah, Sturgis was a great old.
It was.
I mean, especially if you're like putting stuff up your nose. But no, it was really a cool place. I like Bob Spurge, and I still know a lot of people from those days.
Yeah, yeah. But that's gone too.
Yeah, well,
recently.
Bob did not remember to pay, you know, liquor licenses. And so his mind started wandering.
Yeah. Sometimes those things can slip your mind.
It can happen.
Yes.
So this guy, Diaz, almost destroyed the alehouse. I mean, he got rid of the good bartender. I mean, it was just that's when Arthur and five or six other alcoholic friends of his from Figaro's came over and bought the alehouse from Joe Diaz.
What year would that have been? Do you know?
I think that would have been about 1979 or 68 or something like that. I'm terrible with these numbers. And so no sooner they buy it. And these guys, I mean, this was a group of, you can't believe these guys could, you know, do anything, correctly or normal. I mean, just one fuck up after another. Well, as luck would have it, the place catches fire. And so amazingly, now this is really amazing because there was a butcher shop named Pete's Butcher Shop right across the side street, Whelan. And so they just, 30 drunks lifted up that bar, carried it right out and blocked off North Avenue and marched it right into the doorway of Pete's Butcher Shop. And they barely missed a beat. Then they turned it into a 4 o'clock. Now, of course, that changed the character of the place dramatically. But they always kept the jazz thing and, that kind of hipster element. Like that.
What year was the mural drawn?
That was right about 81. That was by a woman named Maureen Munson. Okay. Who she, and last heard was in, that was last heard maybe 34 years ago in the Nut House. But she was very quite talented commercial artist, and she would bring only people she liked, and she would pose right. I could never get people to pose for my stuff. I have to use photographs. But she would get them to pose, and she'd paint them directly on the wall. And a lot of them are remarkably good renditions, too.
Yeah. For those listening, there is a giant mural in the Old Town Ale House of old regulars. And that kind of spurred on, that was continued by you, Bruce, when you...
Well, when my ex-wife and I got the bar, and I ordered the bar, she thought it would be a good idea. Now, I couldn't infringe on the... I've done a little infringing on the mural, but she suggested I just do portraits of the regulars. And, of course, the first couple I did, they were... probably too large because I realized, well, hell, I got to get way more people up, so I had to make them smaller. Right. And so it depending. Now, when people displease me, they go down.
Yes, there is a hierarchy.
There's a hierarchy, and, you got to...
Terry was recently afraid that he had been taken down, but then we found him.
We would never do that.
No, we found him, and I think in a better spot. He's right in the Pollock corner over there.
Yeah.
And I think in a better spot than he used to be. Chris has been upgraded, my business partner.
Definitely, way upgraded.
Way upgraded. He is now above the thermostat at the end of the bar.
Well, and we have to determine where to put you then. We have to...
Well, there's no picture of me.
No, with that, I just came to buy a light bulb just went off in my head.
Oh, might be all right.
I think I may have to be a little. I just jumped back with my easel when doing my latest Golden Showers painting, so I really have no excuse.
Yes, we should talk about that. I never made it up on the wall because I was a after hours regular. I would come in at 3
o'clock. Yeah, if I wasn't familiar with you, you were.
Yeah, so I was working. Unlike Chris, my business partner, I was working.
He was definitely a barfly from the very beginning.
Yes, absolutely. But you put the easel down for a while, but now you are back, which I got a preview of it on, I don't even know what I posted about, something on Facebook, but Bruce simply commented with a rendition of his new picture, which is called
Golden Showers.
Golden Showers.
I basically put, I don't even know how many friends and stuff I have. I get suspended a lot from Facebook. But every time I'd see, I didn't recognize a lot of names. I just comment on anything. Like, congratulations on the marriage of my daughter. And I post the Stormy picture. And people, do you feel that's appropriate, Bruce? I said, yeah, I feel it's appropriate.
It's like a hello from Bruce, picture of Stormy Daniels peeing on our president.
With the controversial part, well, I don't show the stream, but the controversial part, of course, is Melania holding little baby Baron, observing this.
This is true. Yeah, and I didn't notice that.
I've got little feedback on little Baron.
People don't like you making fun of Baron, they feel
it's inappropriate, which pretty much sums me up.
Right, right. Yeah. Little do they know this is Bruce we're talking about.
I get a lot more inappropriate than that.
Yeah, I was going to say the first time I remember. Here, the real national news was the Sarah Palin drawing.
Well, we hit the jackpot on that one. Yeah, that was actually the first political one I ever did.
That was the first time I also remember you referring to yourself as the genius.
Oh, no. Well, see, I just got a lot more acclaim. Oh. I mean, I was referring to myself quite long before.
Maybe that's just the first time I believed you were a genius.
Well, sometimes it takes that. And it was the circumstances of that were kind of amusing because I watched, like everybody else, the Republican convention in 2008, and all of a sudden this woman, this hick woman from Alaska appears with these harlot red high heel shoes and swinging her ass around, and they talk McCain, poor pathetic McCain, into appointing her as running mate. And I thought, my God. And they sexualize her right there, and the Republicans did. So I went down. And that, in those days, my studio was in the basement of the alehouse. So I went down. I was down there for about 6 days, working furiously. I went over to the zoo, and I sketched a polar bear. And I got, you know, pictures. I had to get... when the shit hit the fan and all the TV cameras came in, we got death threats, we got everything. When I posted the picture on a Thursday evening.
For the listeners, the picture in question, the painting, is a nude of Sarah Palin standing.
Full frontal
nude, yes. There's nothing left to the imagination. And she is on a polar bear rug holding an M16, I believe.
Well, I'm kind of made it a little fancier assault weapon.
Oh, okay.
And looking out on the, some people like to think it's Russia, but it's really just the Alaskan landscape with an elk or moose or something in the lake.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was a beautifully done picture, but I didn't, I put it on the wall. And the kids from Second City came in and they took pictures. And then I knew nothing about the internet. It was zero.
Right.
And I put it on. And then the following morning when I came in to open the bar, like 8, 9 in the morning, I got a call from Paris. I could barely understand the first, so I put somebody else on the phone. And they wanted permission to put the picture in this Paris paper. A Parisian paper. I said, well, how do you know about it? He said, oh, it's all over Europe. I went, what? And that's when the TV camera, the Tribune and the Sun Times, apparently I got more, when the Tribune had the really clever guy, a photographer came in and he stacked books in such a way you could not see the most offensive naked parts of Sarah.
Right. I remember that.
So they put it on their website or something, and we broke some kind of the yearly record, got more hits. So when I, I love dealing with the shock jocks because they were calling and basically they were all right wing stuff and they're attacking me. Well, once I figured it took 2 or 3 calls before I could spot this is going to be a hostile call.
Yeah.
So I attacked them before, you know, because what they do is they call me names and then hang up. So I didn't really get a chance to go after their mamas. You know, the stuff I like to do. In fact, one of them, it was like Billy and Leif from Mississippi, and they called me, you and me, Lola. I said, you know, gentlemen, I didn't go to NAMM and get my left arm blown off to lose my First Amendment, rights.
Yeah, yeah.
So, oh, we didn't know you was a vet. You know, yeah, well, I am, and I'm very proud of it. Now, so about 10 minutes later, some yahoo comes flying in the bar. Apparently, he listened on the internet to this shit. And he's, you got your left arm? I said, are you?
It was stolen valor, Bruce.
I said, are you attacking my character? Is that what you would do? But to up the ante, after a couple days of this, somebody asked me who my model was. I said, my daughter. I said, I used my daughter for Sarah.
No.
And that, oh, God, that's now I got on Pederast West website and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
I loved it. I mean, it was great. But we did get a lot of death threats.
They're always empty death threats from those people.
Well, but I thought that was a 1 in 1 million. And then when Blagojevich got in his little trouble, our governor.
This is my favorite painting by you.
Well, thank you. I'll give you a poster.
Yeah, the Blagojevich painting is sort of a preview of maybe what he could expect in his jail sentence.
I think it was prescient.
I love it because it is regulars' faces on the jail guards. And
inmates.
Yes, and the fellow inmates. And
it's called cavity search.
It's called cavity search. And the look on Ruben's face, I think, might be my favorite.
He's putting on the latex glove.
Yes, he's strapping on the latex glove and looking very gleeful.
There's a guy that has a collectible store named Ronnie Holloway that comes to the bar. And the night before Blagojevich was going bye-bye, he was signing autographs. Only Blagojevich would do this. He's signing autographs outside of his Ravenswood house. Ronnie goes over with one of my posters that I had done of this and gets him to sign the thing.
Of course he would. He has no shame.
He's an amazing guy. Yeah.
Zero shame.
Yeah. But that the one thing, but once again, all of a sudden that went viral. And the only difference was this time, no death threats for Blago. Nobody.
No one cared.
I think they cared, but they didn't care that he was going to be going to.
Certainly down south they didn't. They were like, oh, yeah. Yeah. I hope that Democrat gets molested in jail.
No, nobody really minded.
No. So to me, this is the start of like the second coming of the Ale House because, you know, suddenly you guys are on the TV. When does the blog start? Did it start around that time or before that?
The blog started, let's see. Yeah, it started after, right about a little after 2008, I think. That was right when Roger Ebert kept trying to get my daughter to persuade her to make me, because I didn't know how to work a computer or anything. So,
yeah. So Robert
had to
Ebert,
do everything.
Roger was one of your best friends.
Well, he was a very good friend. Yeah,
very good
old
friend.
Bar friend that continued long after he quit bars.
Right. And he kind of said, hey, you should write a blog. And you were like, what's a blog?
I had no idea. But he kept my daughter and my ex-wife were very computer savvy people. So it didn't appeal to me at first. And then, but it turned out quite well because he said, believe me, you do start doing this, you do it every day. Just write. And I would say, well, what if I don't have anything to talk about? He said, just write the first sentence. I mean, he gave me a little, and then he would critique some of the early blogs and say, no, that was really, you know, it was very constructive. It was really useful criticism. And
most importantly, he would occasionally tweet it out.
Well, when he would plug me, I remember one time I got 60,000 hits.
Wow.
I didn't realize that he was as far as intellectual, cultural stuff, he was getting 2.5 million hits a day. You know, this, he couldn't talk. This was his way of communicating.
Right. Yeah.
And, he couldn't, you know, he wasn't that mobile or anything. So he was doing that. And it was amazing. I mean, so then, had a chance with him, and Anthony Bourdain was a big fan of Roger. He's a huge movie fan, Bourdain is. And he calls up my daughter's on the phone, says, her eyes are popping out, and it's Anthony Bourdain wants to talk to me.
He just calls out of the blue, huh?
He called my daughter first to say that he wanted to talk to me.
Okay.
And so my daughter said, well, do you know who he is? I says, he's an actor. I didn't know.
Yeah.
But believe me, my ex-wife was a fairly prominent chef in New York for a while, and she knew who Anthony Bourdain. And ironically, he tried to get a job where she was working at the French place, La Colombe d'Or. I looked on the internet who this guy is, and he's written these books. Turns out, I mean, the guy's an excellent writer.
He really was.
And but he had a book line, and so he wanted to convert my blog into a book. And that went on for almost like two, you know, it was like I had no idea what I'm doing. I mean, this is, you know, he wanted me to have his agent, one top agent in New York, and he said she's the best. And the money was very interesting. And so everything was going along beautifully. I was also, the book was finally done. I was going to go to New York and go on a publicity tour with him for about a week. And then I was going to go out. They were going to send me out to the West Coast, I think, with some woman. And they had it all set up. And they figured I couldn't go on their regular friendly shows. They had to put me on hostile shows. And Bourdain assured them I would thrive in hostile environments.
Yeah, I don't see you on Good Morning America.
No, they weren't going to use me on that stuff. And so everything was cool. And then I get the agent calls and says, Bruce, we have a little problem here. And the problem is the lawyers need to talk to you at HarperCollins because Echo Press is a subsidiary of HarperCollins. So I thought that, I'd clear it with the agent. I said, well, you know, can I still use my blog name, you know, nicknames and stuff. Oh, yeah, sure, just nicknames. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Well, this nasty little bitch calls me up and who's a lawyer at HarperCollins. And she, what a horrible little, I think her name was Trina, something like that. And she, with her voice, you know, she hated me. She hated the book.
Uh-huh.
She hated everything that I stood for. And she says, well, in a perfect world, all your characters would be either dead or signed releases. I said, well, a lot of them are dead, and I'm sure they'll all give me releases. Well, she was so annoying. I kind of used a lot of abusive language in the course of our interview. And so Bourdais kind of gets hysterically. He calls me up. She says, what the hell did you say to these people? I mean, they said it was the most libelous, defamatory thing that's ever come across. To his knowledge, or the Echo Press guy, they never can't pull the plug on the book before. They said, oh, no. There's no way we're going to give you permission. So ultimately, I self-published.
Gotcha.
I got to keep my money.
You did. Well, yeah. That's...
But so I didn't think Anthony and I would be too pally-wally after that, but then he came back and did a whole show.
Yeah, he did two shows, really, on the
old
time.
Well, he did the first one before the
before the book. Okay.
The layover, and then he went to CNN.
The Parts Unknown show.
Yeah.
Which was truly, that episode is all about the old Tom Aliens.
Yes, and the genius. And I like to say that was the first time he ever played the part of the sidekick on his show.
And your guys' friendship really was real. It was
We developed over 5 or 6 year time. It was he talked to me a lot. We communicated a lot. Yeah,
yeah, and he even called you to tell you to lay off of his girlfriend.
Yes,
huh?
Yes,
Asia.
This really, truly awful creature that when I saw that TV show, oh God.
The one that she's in with him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I mean, you just smell the odors coming out of her vagina over the TV screen. It was so loathsome, woman. Ugh. I did a portrait of her cutting Harvey Weinstein's throat.
Yeah, yeah. So
with Rose McGowan in the background.
Yeah, which was kind of an empowering thing, but yeah, you hate her. That was before you...
They liked it. That's what he called me up eventually. He said, Bruce, quit making fun of Aja and Rose, because I would say, oh, you're my hero. I would do this on the internet. Oh, you're my hero. Lead us. You're the bravest. You're so heroic. You're wonderful. You're wonderful. And they would buy it. And then I did the picture. And so Bourdais got involved on that on Twitter. And he says, obviously, I think the name, there's an Italian, the only Italian Renaissance woman famous is somebody called, I think, I believe it's pronounced Gentilici, something like that. Because she had every reason to cut men's throats. And there's some really those classic, beautifully done paintings. But I said, no, it was Caravaggio. So he says, I don't think so. I says, I really think, you know, it's more in the... So we get in this this argument, who I'm more influenced by, Gentilici or Caravaggio, about the throat cutting. But in the meantime, that kind of went viral too.
It did. And certainly, I do remember right after Anthony died, you know, a lot of us were going to the old town in the days after he
I don't think
died.
He had a clue how people... I know he knew, he was a celebrity, he knew all that. I don't think he had a clue how emotionally involved people were with him. Because after he died, it was like if he came to the alehouse, it was like he could connect with other people. And we're still getting that. I mean, it's just really a shame. I knew that he was not real happy guy the last time I saw him at the Lily Pond over at behind Lincoln Park Zoo. And I asked him, I said, because we'd spent the whole week together doing the show, mm-hmm. and I knew how hard he worked. You know, it's really a pain in the ass doing one of those shows.
It's terrible.
Just a lot of time and effort goes into that. And he said he was just going to take off for New York spent a couple days with his wife and kid, and then he was flying out to Montana. I think Montana to see Jim Harrison, the writer. And I said, "What the?" I said, "You know, they want to do us a final shot. We walk around the lily pond." So I said, "Yeah, sure." So we're halfway around. And I said, "We're just two of us." I said, "You know, everybody I know wants to be you." I said, "I don't." I said, "You're leaving here." She says, "Hey, yeah, I'm gone 255 days a year. I'm flying, going here, going there." I said, "I wouldn't want to do that." I said, "Sure, do a little traveling. You know, I like food. I like going places, but this is obsessive." I said, "What the hell are you running away from?" He looks at me right in the eye. He says, "I don't know, man. I don't know." And then I could see, you know, the guy, something was really wrong with him. You know, he was not a happy camper with all the success. And but I certainly wouldn't have predicted it would have reached a point. It
did. No, it's pretty shocking. And, when I first read his first book, or at least the first book I read, The Kitchen Confidential.
Well, that's his best, too.
I mean, it spoke to me. Like, that was my life growing up. That's what a lot of us in this business experienced. It was the most realistic portrayal of growing up in the restaurant business that I had ever read. And, it was, I don't think he did understand the effect that he had on a lot of people, and and the long-lasting effect he's had on the restaurant business, because I think a lot of people have gotten into this business because of shows like his, if not directly his show, you know, and so it's kind of transformed things.
Right, and it kind of makes sense to me as more of an outsider why he would be attracted to you, because I think there's an authenticity, and with him there was an authenticity to what he did. I don't know if you agree or not, but with you,
well, I couldn't argue that would be your attraction to me. But, I'd hardly argue with that. But we had a very unusual. Well, when my daughter, who doesn't say flattering things about me, rarely if ever, but somebody asked her what Bourdain was. They asked her what Bourdain was like. He says, "Oh, he's like my father." So that was, I don't know quite how to take that.
Yeah, but right.
We have the same, roughly same sense of humor and view of life. Although towards the end we were arguing more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I've had to be on a few TV shows, you know, because of these restaurants that I own and all that. And I do always kind of think, you know, I always thought in the back of my mind, like, just act like Bourdain. Just act like Bourdain, you know, and be authentic, say what you feel, and let it all, you know, take care of itself. And, to this day, there's no one on TV who's doing that. It's all such shit.
There's no way you can do that.
I mean, these food shows are terrible. Well, and everyone's trying to act like them, and that is, like, making them less authentic.
Yeah, and I think there's just so much pressure to not be authentic.
Yeah.
There's so much pressure to say what people want you to say.
It's either a smiling idiot or someone trying to be edgy and not pulling it off.
Yeah, well, when people ask me what he's like, I mean, they do all the time. I just said he's just not a... I mean, when you see him on TV, that's how he is, except uncensored, you know, off.
Yeah.
But same. He doesn't change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and that really, to me, is why the Old Town has been able to survive. It's the last survivor of Old Town. And your ability to make it relevant to new generations that, you know, I don't even understand this new generation. I can't imagine, Bruce, you have any idea what these kids want. I don't.
Well, when you see those hats turned backwards marching, I mean, you know, you're doing something. Now, the one thing good about music, the type of music, Grasshopper our jukebox czar, one of our bartenders, the jukebox czar. This kid, the kids with the hats turned backwards do not like our music, and
that's
so
true.
That's good. That's kind of
It's good for me, because every time I go in, I want to feed the jukebox. I don't have to wait for 20 songs to go by before I hear mine. They usually just come right on.
That's what we have a big fight with our jukebox guy, Jukebox Joe, because he wants one of those modern Mm-hmm. Computer ones? No, no. We have to have the old-fashioned where we have total control. Yeah,
don't you ever put one of those in there,
well,
please.
The problem is parts, you know, that those old ones.
It is the problem. Yeah, we're having that problem at Patty Long's.
Yeah, but it's really, and it's very important, the music. We always keep a little classical. And the original Ale House, there was a great bartender named Lowell Williams, and young guy, very handsome guy. And I remember for some reason I was off to the golf course, but it was raining. This is back in the early 60s. And it was raining, so I just said, what the hell, go over to the Ale House and have a beer. Well, a bunch of construction guys in hard hats came in, and because of the rain. So they're all there, about six, seven of them. They take a table, and they're all screaming and yelling. And racial, you know, thrust in the N-word around. I mean, really asshole guys. So Lowell just smiled primly. He says, watch, just watch. He puts opera, he puts La Boheme on the record player. Mm-hmm. Within minutes, they start squirming and just wriggling around in their chairs, and just the facial expressions are just, and within 10 minutes, they all get, oh, I hate this place. And they just got up. And that was a huge lesson to me. I mean, that works.
So opera is a douchebag repellent.
Oh, it's kryptonite.
Oh, interesting. Make note of that.
Yes, you might want to.
That's a good tip.
Yep.
So out of all of, you know, I'm going to ask the classic celebrity question. You get a lot of celebrities in there. Who's your favorite?
Well, of all the Second City people, Gilda Radner was my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
She was just great. And she was nice and funny. She was hilarious. And
there's a new biopic about her out.
It looks awful, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. But no, she really, I really liked her.
Yeah.
I knew David Steinberg pretty good. We used to play football he's actually pretty good football. Well, little guy, fast. We go over to the park and play Dutch football stuff. I never got real chummy with the old timers. I mean, I knew them, enough to say hello to them all. And it's funny though. I was told by Beatrice when she got the bar, sometimes I'd be a little. Sarcastic, overly sarcastic, perhaps. Some of the big, I won't even mention their names because a couple of them still come in once in a while. And they go, why? Hey, he's really, that guy down there is really an asshole. You know, I thought, Jesus Christ, these are professional comics. You can't come back with something. You're going to just whine to the owner that somebody said something. God, I couldn't believe that.
A lot of comics are pretty dour off stage, aren't they?
Well, Jim Belushi was just a total asshole. I've said this on other podcasts, and I kicked his ass in there one night, and he never came back.
Yeah?
Oh, beautiful job on him. Beautiful.
I met him once. He came into Corcoran's and was handing out chocolates from the fudge pot to all the ladies.
How nice of him.
Yes.
Yeah, well, he was just a talentless asshole. But his brother was, of course, terrific. Yeah, but right. His brother would come in, and he would sit by the jukebox with that real adore look on his, you know. I've seen him in the house maybe 100 times, never saw him laugh once. And he would look real, like nobody knew who he was. And then conduct his drug deals, with, you know, whisper, with some guy get up and go out and stuff. Yeah, his personality was really quite odd. Chris Farley was in there. He was kind of trying to imitate John Belushi, but he was totally on guy. He was clowning and stuff. Mm-hmm. He came in a lot, but he was in the night he died. He left the Ale House and went over to, the Hancock Building, and boom.
Yeah.
But, he was
I waited on him once. He was very nice. Very nice.
Nice guy, yeah.
Remember, I liked him. He was drinking double screwdrivers.
Yeah, he did that.
Yeah. So, because I know you don't give a fuck, who's the worst celebrity?
Well, I mean, I would...
Jim Belushi.
I would say definitely. I mean, it was packed in there, and I knew he was going to take a swing at me. I'd been provoking him. And So I grabbed his hair and tucked him in, you know, real tight, because I knew they'd break it up in a second. So I just tucked him in right by my, and so I just kept hitting with my right knee. And then there's a guy,
because he's, I mean, he's not like a tall guy, but he's a stocky guy.
He's stocky, but yeah. Well, he doesn't, he can't, I'll tell you what, he's not a good puncher because he missed when he tried to hit me. So to this guy, Jim Lundberg, great big guy, because they couldn't break the fight up. We were right by the corner window by the where I kind of sit now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Jim managed to lift both of us up. And he was a great big guy. He played football at Miami University and kind of carried us, slid us out the door and out the side where they could pull us apart. So he was an asshole. I don't think anybody nobody stands out worse. Because when Jim Belushi, he just got college.
You didn't get in fisticuffs with any other celebrities?
Not.
No, that's the only one.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think one.
Bruce is wily. I not that long ago. I mean, and you know, you don't have to reveal your age, Bruce, but you're.
Oh, I'm 78.
78 years old.
No, I've been saying that since I was 42. I've finally grown into my IDs.
But I remember not that long ago. I mean, Patty Long's was open. I think you. Caught a guy, and this is every bar owner's dream.
Oh, in the bathroom.
Yes, you know, for people that don't know, people, the human race seems to lose their minds in bar bathrooms, and they take it out on paper dispensers and
sinks
toilets. And toilets, and certainly in the back of the toilets, they like to smash those. And you walked in on one of these idiots.
I was stalking this guy because somebody was in there doing stuff. I knew that.
Yeah.
And I finally, there was this young kid, kind of young, good-looking kid with some other young people, and real drunk, real. So I was just kind of suspicious. That guy was narrowing it down. That was the guy going in and doing stuff. So I went in there, and I waited about a minute, walk in. He's trying to rip the towel dispenser off the wall. Oh, it's your dream to catch him. Now,
it is.
I made a big mistake. The mistake was we had this very coarse walls put in to keep up graffiti off. And had I been thinking, I would have taken his face and rubbed it up and down on that on the wall.
The stucco wall.
But
yeah.
but he was a pretty boy, so that would have been really, you know, probably very effective. But anyway, so yeah, the kid's way younger than me. I was, but I started smacking him. And so my ex-wife tells the bartender, no, you got to tell Bruce. So the kid's that he's in the field position on the floor. I'm just stopping him now.